Well, welcome back. As always, it is a pleasure to be with you this week. Hope everyone's having a wonderful start to the spring. We are back once again here in studio for a Squared Away conversation, which we do at the end of every quarter. We're going to look back at 2024's Q1. And as is always the case for these conversations, I'm joined here this morning by Zach Reynolds, our Chief Investment Officer, and our investment analyst, Austin Burke. So, gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for joining me. Hope you guys are having recording this during Masters Week. So,
The day of the eclipse.
And the eclipse.
Yes. So, if tomorrow doesn't come because the eclipse happens, then it was great to work with you too.
Yeah. I like our chances.
No, so a lot going on top of just the market that we've had that we're going to talk about today. So anyway, but let's jump in here. We can start wherever you guys, let's start at the data actually. Let's kind of look at what the market did in the first quarter, some of the key metrics you two are watching, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, sounds great. So it was a great first quarter for markets, like a broken record, particularly so for U.S. large cap stocks. The S&P gained 10.5%. And last quarter, I know we talked a lot about Wall Street predictions and projections and how far off they often are.
Right.
And so I always kind of chuckle. It's so hard to make short-term predictions about market movements. But as I recall, this year, Wall Street's back to predicting about a 10% return, which is the long-run average for stocks. So it's not like they're out on a limb. But we've already hit that in the first quarter. So now you see all these Wall Street people kind of scramble to adjust their target, or some of them decide, oh, I'm going to be contrarian and say, oh, we're going to fall from here. But regardless, it was a really good quarter for stocks. The S&P 500 made 22 new all-time highs, which I know we'll talk a little bit about how to think about investing when markets are hitting all-time highs. It was the best opening quarter since 2019. And then from an economic standpoint, the data has just been really, really strong and better than expected, kind of consistently really going back the last 5 or 6 quarters. And you've seen this narrative go from, we really expect a recession. It's 6 months away. We heard that for 3 years, I think.
Right.
And then, you know, it kept not coming. Then it was like, well, maybe we'll have a soft landing. And now there's a substantial line of thinking that, you know, we may not have a landing at all. And I read someone the other day saying, that doesn't mean we don't think there will ever be a recession again, which obviously we know we'll have more recessions.
Right.
Just this cycle, it may be pushed off pretty far into the future. So a lot of the economic data is encouraging. As always, we'll be quick to say the stock market does not equal the economy and vice versa. So just because you have a strong economy doesn't mean stocks will keep going up. A lot of that good news, in our view, gets priced in very quickly. Valuations are pretty high, particularly when you look at U.S. large cap stocks. So something we talk about a lot internally is how to think about future returns from here.
Right.
It feels good when markets are making all-time highs. People look at their statements and they're up. But when you think about the next 5 to 10 years, when valuations are really high, that probably implies somewhat lower returns rather than higher returns.
Which is something we talked about back in, what would it have been, probably 21, talking about how high the valuations were getting. And then you saw, I mean, among other things, and there's other reasons for it, but you did see the valuations get lowered because of XYZ.
That's right. And, you know, that's one of the reasons we talk about diversification and how important it is. And, you know, today it feels a lot better to take some profits from stocks, rebalance portfolios, add to fixed income when rates are, you know, where they are today versus where they were 3 years ago. You can get a reasonable rate of return from bonds. And Austin, maybe talk a little bit about how bonds performed in the last quarter, what interest rates are doing, to kind of give some context there.
Right. At the start of the year, I mean, most people are, what you were reading and what you were looking at, a lot of people are saying 5-6 rate cuts over the course of the year. But listening to what the Fed has been saying, and then also just kind of with the data coming in, it's starting to look like people are saying maybe 3 cuts now. And so over the course of the first quarter, you've actually seen bond prices go down, rates go up. Those work in an inverse relationship. And so the U.S. ag declined roughly 1% over the first quarter with those rates going up. But it's been interesting to see what the Fed has been saying and talking about what they're looking at moving forward, but it's been slightly different and kind of hasn't been as fast to cut rates as people were kind of expecting.
Sure. One thing, I get both your opinions here. You know, we laid out, we've already really talked about it, other than maybe outside the bonds kind of being flat and not being, you know, amazing data, but there's economic wise, there is strengthening data out there. But yet the second one little glimpse of bad news or bad report comes out, it's like the market's like, oh yeah, there's my chance. I'm going to take it off. Does that make sense? Do you feel like there are times when the market, or just really some of the talking heads, are just looking for one little piece of negative information?
I think so, because like you think about how anything's priced, how securities are priced. It's all the marginal buyer kind of sets the price, right? So when you have a whole lot of people who are long, a whole lot of people who are bullish, yes, you can get some of those dynamics where all of a sudden there's really no one to buy from. There's no sellers. And then you can kind of get that domino effect. Now, that said, I do think when you look at narratives or how we as humans, and this kind of gets into Daniel Kahneman, who passed away recently, and we talk a lot about him, but we all tell ourselves these stories to make sense of the world. If stock prices were going down right now, we would point to all these things, which are true today, as here's the reason why, right? You had, it looks like, a potential for a much wider conflict in the Middle East, for example. Oil prices that are heading up and potentially going to $100 a barrel. There are all these things, an economy that you could argue might get too hot and the Fed may not cut rates at all.
Right.
If stocks were going down, that's the story we'd be telling ourselves.
Right, we could flip it. And,
exactly. Yep. Instead, stocks are going up. And so we say, well, you know, things are really good. Yeah. Yes, there's a few bad things. But the jobs report last week, Tyler, was really, really strong. Unemployment actually ticked down to 3.8%. And for a while, the narrative in the market was, hey, good news is bad news. That means the Fed's not going to cut. Last week, you saw the market kind of go, you know what? Good news is good news. Yeah. The stocks actually rallied, which honestly, if I were betting on that and you told me that jobs number in advance, I would have said, oh, stocks are going to go down because that means these rate cuts are going to get pushed out even further. And in fact, you know, you are, we had first talked about, as Austin said, up to 6 rate cuts starting in the spring of this year. Now, I was looking on Bloomberg earlier today, about 50-50 whether we cut in June. If you don't get that, then you're kind of getting closer to the election, which the Fed has some sensitivity around how politically motivated
they want to Bank of America who said if they don't start cutting in June, that they won't cut for the rest of the year to avoid having any effect or looking like they're trying to have any effect on the election.
One of our research groups that sends out, you know, daily reports talked about that, how policymakers, it's basically policymakers and the Fed, and they've got to figure out that the Feds can't, you know, upset the policymakers, and policymakers aren't doing them any favors with some of the stuff they're doing. And it, man, it's just such a, I do not envy the Fed seat at all trying to look at that.
No, it's unfortunate that so many decisions going back to, you know, the global financial crisis and ever since, the responsibility for helping the economy has really been mostly on the Fed, because Congress just has trouble acting in a very quick or very thoughtful way.
Mature adult.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've really gone over the data. Any other kind of data points? We've hit on bonds, we've hit on equities.
I mean, consumers, which as we all know are the large majority of the U.S. economy, the spending's been really good. The confidence has gone back up. And, you know, a very strong jobs market plays into that and helps people feel like they can change jobs if they need to. People have seen wage increases. You know, we can argue about how much of that's inflation versus how much of it's real wage growth. But still, people are making more money. The housing market, I think, is an interesting dynamic there, where you have a lot of people locked into low interest rates, and that prevents people from wanting to move very much. But we're also very supply constrained. So as you see more supply come online, you do see people still buying.
Mm-hmm.
That's all good. So the data really looks good right now.
Okay, so let's move into, we already hit on it because you mentioned 22 new all-time highs in the quarter. And I, among probably you two and our other advisors, it's like, wait, if we're in an all-time high today, why? I don't want to invest. You know, let's wait, let's hold off. And then 5 days later, you had another new all-time high.
That's right.
So let's talk about investing at all-time highs, because you put some data in the market update, Zach, that went back and looked over a very substantial period of time, which is always the best thing we can do instead of looking at 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, and I can, obviously my career, this 15 plus years now of doing this, and this is something that almost always happens when you have really good markets. People get more hesitant to put money to work. Understandably, I mean, no one wants to put their money to work and then see the market go down 20%. That feels really painful to Daniel Kahneman, talked a lot about that. Loss aversion is a real thing. Losses, you feel much more pain than you do pleasure from gains.
Right.
That's been proven over and over. So it's a real thing that people want to try to avoid. But as you said, Tyler, we really have to look at the data. And what it says is, if you're going to invest in the stock market for decades, which, if you're listening and you're investing in stocks, that's what you should, that's the time horizon.
If you haven't already noticed, like that's our approach.
That's right. But what that means is you're going to be investing money at all-time highs a fair amount of the time.
Right.
It's actually surprising when you look at the numbers. And shout out to Ben Carlson at A Wealth of Common Sense. He's got some great data on this. He found from 2013 to 2019, the S&P traded at all-time highs 14% of the time. So what is that, one in seven-ish days, you've got markets at all-time highs. For the 2020s so far, 11% of all trading days have been at all-time highs.
It's crazy.
And going back to the 1950s, the S&P has averaged more than 17 new all-time highs per year. That's one every 15 trading days over half a century. So the numbers just say, you know, markets go up over time. And that by definition means they're going to trade at all-time highs quite a bit. Kind of the second piece of that, though, is, well, maybe markets hit all-time highs and then they tend to have worse results after that. That's, we have enough data, we can look at that. JP Morgan did some good research on this. This kind of even surprised me.
I know.
These numbers were surprising. But they looked at from 1970 to 2023, so 53-year period. If you chose any random day to invest, you had positive results 75% of the time over the next 1 year. So any random day, the average gain from there was 10.5. I'm sorry, the median gain was 10.5%. So, okay, that all makes sense.
It checks, yep.
If you only limit your investing to days where markets are at all-time highs.
So only new money in
exactly.
S&P.
You have to invest on a day where markets hit all-time highs. The median and average returns were actually better,
even worse.
Markets were up 73% of the time, so slightly less, 73% time versus 75. But the median return was 12.1%. So
that's crazy.
What that says, and you know, having been worked in markets for a long time, we kind of see this, there's some clustering too,
yeah,
right? You kind of, momentum is a real thing in markets. And when markets are making all-time highs, they tend to continue making all-time highs until something, you know, doesn't work, something happens, people get, you know,
whatever.
You run out of buyers at some point.
Yep.
But kind of the net effect for me is, because none of us here and none of you out there have the ability to time markets, and you don't know what's going to happen in the future, it's not reasonable, therefore, to say, oh, markets are all-time highs, I'm going to wait a little while and invest when markets turn over. 2019 is a great example. I know you, and it sounds like you and David talked about that. That was a year where we had, you know, you had some people with fresh cash, and I remember people wanting to average into the market, and we'll talk about that maybe in a second too, but the market just went up and up and up almost every day. And so it's a really uncomfortable feeling as a portfolio manager to be chasing a market that's going up and away from you,
because
you're just paying higher prices and higher prices. And, you know, the dollar cost averaging thing is interesting. A lot of people, when they hear it, it makes intuitive sense to them and they are like, oh, that's absolutely the best way to do it. In fact, it's really not. And it's very easy to, like, when you kind of think through why, if you had a pile of money, it would be better to just invest it all at once. It's because, again, markets go up over time. You don't know today versus tomorrow versus the next day.
Yeah.
So the thought experiment that I think this is Cliff Asness who wrote this. He probably wrote
owning,
it. We've been, Austin and I have been trading a lot of Cliff Asness papers back and forth from AQR. But he says, if someone handed you a fully diversified portfolio, you would say, great, thank you, I'm going to hold on to this portfolio. You wouldn't sell it to then
uninvest it.
You wouldn't uninvest to then dollar cost average.
To then average in. Right.
Right. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
No one would do that. The same is true if you get handed a pile of cash. Mathematically speaking, and looking back over history, it would be better to go ahead and fully invest it. Again, not to say that we don't do some dollar cost averaging because clients ask us to, or we are trying to minimize regret if markets do go down. But academically speaking, it's not the optimal approach.
Yeah. And so just to put some context around this, if we've got a client comes in with, let's say they've got, you know, sell the business, they've got a couple million dollars, that is a different conversation than somebody that has $50,000. It's a little easier for us as advisors to convince the person with $50,000, let's dump it in, than it is for the client with $4 million. But it's actually the same exact conversation we're having. And the research does show us that, you know, let's put it in instead of trying to spread this million out over every year. You will miss out on something.
Exactly right. You're just making timing decisions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it comes down to, like, how long do we want to wait? It, you know, Is there some threshold you want to see the market fall? Well, we've seen in the past that could be years until you hit that, you know, 10% pullback or whatever it may be. It is a short-term timing game that on average is going to destroy value, not create value. Yeah. Again, not to say there aren't times where, you know, if this was December of 2021 and you played that game, well, you won
right.
if you DCA'd, but that's not the most frequent result from playing
and, you're making a bet or you're taking a gamble on on which way you think the flip of the coin is going to fall.
Exactly.
So as we kind of get into Daniel Kahneman here, and I want you guys to kind of tee him up and just what he's meant to the investing and economic world, but between investing at all-time highs, which we just went over, the stat I did bring up with David on the last podcast where in 2020 you had 1% moves, so either up or down 1% 110 times, there's always a reason not to invest. And there's always reason to invest. And I think that's something that Kahneman did a really good job of over his lifetime. So let's spend a little bit of time as we wrap up here talking about him, kind of some of the takeaways you two have just from his insight in his mind, because it sounded like just a really bright guy.
Daniel Kahneman, I'm a huge fan of his. I think most of us in the private wealth world typically are. He was interesting because he was not actually an economist, although he won the Nobel Prize in economics back in the early 2000s. He came at it from a psychologist point of view, and he and Amos Tversky, who was his kind of collaborator, who sadly Amos died in 1996, I believe. So he didn't get to share that Nobel Prize because you have to be alive to win the Nobel Prize, unfortunately. But they did great work on all sorts of topics related to investing, how people think about money, these behavioral traps that we all fall in, and why it was so important. This field of behavioral economics that Kahneman really pioneered is before their work, economists tended to believe that people acted rationally in an economically rational way. And what they showed is people don't. And that has really massive implications for, you know, policymaking, for folks like us who work with actual human beings with money who don't always act rationally. Understanding what those behavioral pitfalls are can help us do a much better job. They can help you out there as an investor make better decisions. And I highly recommend his work. Thinking Fast and Slow, excellent book if you want to look into that. Jason Zweig from the Wall Street Journal wrote a great kind of ode to Daniel Kahneman after he passed away. That's a great one to go out and read.
I read The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis. That one kind of goes more into the background. Thinking Fast and Slow is more kind of his work and presenting his ideas to the world. But if you kind of want the background between him and Amos Tversky and kind of how they developed their friendship, how they conducted their research over time, Michael Lewis has a great book called The Undoing Project about him. But yeah, I think he's very interesting in terms of the world of finance to look at as someone who's kind of kicking off the behavioral finance side of investing. And for a long time, I think it's easy to look at investing as a game of chance or a game of randomness. But I think when you start to look at how you analyze the data and how you analyze personal decisions that you make, I think the better that you can understand the biases that you can succumb to makes you a better investor in the long term. And it doesn't mean you're always going to make the right decision. No one will. But I think it's so easy for us as humans to fall into these behavioral traps, as Zach put it, that the more research and the more understanding that we can have of the way that we process decision-making and information will make us better in the long run and hopefully help us to make better decisions as long as we apply those things.
Kahneman himself, I think, famously said, I have all these behavioral issues myself.
Right.
Like, I just recognize them after I do them.
Yeah.
But
immune to them.
Exactly. I still make those mistakes. And one of the things that I loved in Jason Zweig's article, Kahneman had a great quote. He said, all of us would be better investors if we just made fewer decisions. And that's something that, you know, over my career, I've gravitated more and more toward that. Like, if you can reduce the number of decisions but make higher quality decisions, I think you end up with much better outcomes. And another benefit, as I sit across from a client and talk about the portfolio, is I can say exactly why that portfolio performed the way it did. If you've got 50 different managers, each buying 150 stocks and changing their strategy over time as markets change, it gets really hard to disaggregate all that information and say, this is how we perform the way we did. We really don't have that problem because we have a much more straightforward approach to investing. The other thing I loved in Zweig's article is he talked about how Kahneman invested. And you won't be surprised to hear me say he had most of his money in index funds, which
shocker.
I loved hearing. Not shocking given what a smart guy he was, but it's really is gratifying given that that's our approach to it. Read about people like Kahneman. Read about people like Matt Levine from Bloomberg, who I've talked about before on this podcast and is my favorite current financial writer, who also keeps most of his money in index funds. It just, when you hear really smart people who understand markets that well, vote with their own dollars, exactly consistent with the way we make money, it's very encouraging.
Well, and to go back to kind of awesome what you were talking about too a little bit, this is a really early teaser, but we will have Daniel Crosby back on hopefully in the fall. And he's in works at Orion, one of our major technology partners. And he's a behavioral finance guru. And he has a new book coming out. So we'll have a whole podcast on that, have him back on. But yeah, we probably talk about data and the numbers and the economy about as much as we talk about the behavioral side of investing. So gentlemen, as we close, any other thoughts or comments? You know, one thing that got brought up a lot during the first quarter, at least from the advisor client side of things, and probably in your world too, from people asking you why we're not doing it, is Bitcoin.
Sure.
What's that look like today? I don't think anything's really changed as far as the facts behind Bitcoin, but what would you guys say there as we wrap up?
Yeah, no, I think I've been pretty consistent on this podcast and in our market updates and in my conversations with friends, family, and clients.
Behind the scenes,
My view on Bitcoin, which is not that it can't go higher. Obviously, it can. Yep. It's a simple supply and demand equation.
Yep.
My issue with Bitcoin, you know, doesn't produce any cash flows. It's very hard to value. There's nothing particularly backing it other than its manufactured scarcity, which, you know, credit to Satoshi for coming up with a really interesting way of controlling the supply of something. But people are going to find a way to speculate on assets, whether it's, you know, during COVID, it was, whatever sports betting you could do, cryptocurrencies, meme stocks, all those things. I really don't view it as an asset class that passes the minimum test for me to put into a portfolio as a fiduciary. I understand, and I'm friends with other chief investment officers who have gotten to the point where they feel like they can. And to be fair to them, now having access to Bitcoin in an ETF sort of vehicle does make that conversation easier, makes allocation easier. And I think that's probably part of the reason you saw prices go up. But, you know, it's just not for me. It's not an investment for me.
It's just fascinating to continue to get questions about it. And I, to your point, we have been pretty clear on our view of it. And again, it just doesn't fit the way we invest.
Yeah. I mean, there's, something Austin and I have been talking a lot about, and we continue to spend a lot of focus on, is private investment space, alternatives, whatever you want to call them. And, you know, people can throw Bitcoin in there. But something that we always say to clients is, look, there's millions of things you could invest in the world. If you want to put your money at risk and try to earn a return, I get it. If Bitcoin does that for you, it's just not for us. We tend to have some things that have to be true about an asset for it to meet that minimum standard of going into the portfolio. And I have to be able to point to some economic driver of growth in that asset. So think about private equity. So private businesses obviously can generate cash flows and should, if they sell their product or service for a profit over time, be worth more, right? Private real estate. It's very obvious. People need somewhere to live or do business. Real estate has a long track record of growth. It produces income in the form of rents. Private credit. So private businesses are borrowing money. They have to pay a stated interest rate, or if they don't, the creditor can come in and take over the business. Those all have real economic drivers. It's just Bitcoin doesn't pass that test for me.
Yeah.
I think other thing to think about that's interesting with Bitcoin is, okay, so it hasn't been around forever, but it's been around a decent enough amount of time that you would expect to see some mainstream adoption. But when's the last time you bought something with Bitcoin? It's very rare to find these use cases, or you just don't see that widespread adoption of the utility of what Bitcoin was promised to be, of this new alternative payment currency.
I think that we can put that to bed. Like, truly, like, we're never going to transact in Bitcoin. It's a great speculative vehicle. It has been. People have made money. Again, like, very clear, people have made money speculating on Bitcoin, but is not going to be a medium of exchange. It's way too volatile. I've bought Bitcoin to understand the process.
Sure.
The transaction fees are very high. You would never do a transaction with Bitcoin. If you started doing that every day, it would be very annoying and very costly for you to do that. In fact, I was reading I think it was the Wall Street Journal talking about some arms sales. I can't remember if it was Ukraine or Russia or whoever it was. I think it was Russia getting around arms bans or something. But they're like, hey, we'll just pay us in Bitcoin. And I mean, that is one of the top use cases. And you hear, Charlie Munger, another legend who we lost this year, talked very directly about how Bitcoin is great if you're, wanting to do trafficking of
something
any sort.
Illegal.
Something illegal is one of the top use cases for Bitcoin. And so, I mean, it is a use case, but it's not what I'd want to hang my hat on if I'm investing.
I'll keep my cash. I don't care cash. I'll just keep my, the credit card.
Plastic. Right.
Ready. Plastic. Yeah. Gentlemen, anything else?
Yes, sir.
Okay. As always, I appreciate it. Thank you for all you two do. We will be back again, and it'll be here before we know it. We'll be talking about the second quarter.
That's right.
Maybe a rate cut, maybe not. We don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah. So y'all have a good day. Thanks,
Tyler.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.